It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today we're looking back at some of our favorite science and sci-fi segments from 2014. In November, the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra explored strange new worlds with the PNC Pop's Sci-Fi Spectacular. The concert featured music from classic sci-fi TV programs and films such as 2001, A Space Odyssey, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and Star Trek, among others. It was hosted by actor and activist George Takei, one of the stars of the first Star Trek TV series, who originated the role of the helmsman Sulu. Beyond Star Trek, there were many aspects of this man's life and career to explore, including his role in the award-winning musical Allegiance, which is coming to Broadway in 2015. George Takei sat down in studio with me in November. I began by asking him about his TV work on the show Super Ninjas and working in Pittsburgh.
I first discovered Pittsburgh back in the 70s, and I must say I came with a stereotyped notion of Pittsburgh, a black soot-covered city. But when the cab took me into that tunnel, and we reached a light at the end of the tunnel, and bam, the glory of Pittsburgh hits you. The soaring skyscraper, the fascinating architecture, and the Allegheny and the Monongahela. We crossed the Monongahela, but you see the rivers coming together to form the Ohio. And then while we were filming Super Ninjas, we got to explore the city and get to know it. Market Square and wonderful restaurants. I love New Orleans food, Cajun food, and there it is in all its spiciness. Or on the Strip, there's a relatively new restaurant, Italian restaurant, called Cioppino. And I love Cioppino, but their other Italian dishes are wonderful as well. And then I can't remember the name of the district, farther to the east, a Japanese restaurant called Umi, U-M-I, which means ocean. Superb Japanese restaurant, comparable to Nobu in L.A. or New York, you know. So the dining delights. And being a theater person, I discovered the theater here. Public theater, first-class theater, comparable to New York. And so this is a wonderful city and a city with unique character as well. And that's why so many films are shot here.
Let's talk about Star Trek. It's certainly the thing that you are most identified with. The original series came to TV in 1966. You were a young actor. If I did my math correctly, you were still in your 20s.
Yes.
when this opportunity came about. How did you end up getting the part of Hikaru Sulu? And most of us don't even realize he had a first name because it's just Sulu or Mr. Sulu.
It was slipped in well into the movie series. They didn't refer to Sulu's first name
in the TV series.
Okay,
so here you are. You're Mr. Sulu, helmsman of the Starship Enterprise. How did it happen?
In a very ordinary Hollywood way, my agent called. I went for the interview, met Gene Roddenberry. What was unusual was when you're going up for a pilot film, a series, there's usually a battery of people there, all the studio executives and the potential advertisers, advertising agencies are there. But in the case of the Star Trek interview, it was just Gene Roddenberry. And we didn't have that desk between us. He came out from behind the desk, ushered me to a corner area with sofas, and we had a nice conversation. And he described the series to me. And I was absolutely thrilled just listening to the description of the series. And for a young actor who'd been, bobbing around in Hollywood doing small guest shots and not very, the most satisfying roles. And here he was describing a starship, a metaphor for the planet Earth and its diversity coming together and working in concert. And the cast was going to reflect that. And he said that it's a show that's going to have an optimistic view of our future. I wanted to do the series.
How did that change your life?
It was a life-changing experience because my first series, steady work. I mean, just those practical things. But also looking forward to each script because it was a quality show. We had great writers. Gene Roddenberry had written the Bible for the show, and it talked about it. He used science fiction as a metaphor for issues of the times. So we dealt with the civil rights movement, with which I was personally engaged as well. Also the Vietnam War. It was a time of the hippie movement, and that was reflected. And it was a point where the Cold War was at its coldest, and that too was a part of what we talked about. So it was exciting to look forward to the scripts and see what issue we might be dealing with. So it was a show that I'm proud to be associated with. And thanks to the fan support, we got a movie series out of it 10 years after we were canceled.
Well, and I was going to ask you about that because, as you just said, 10 years. So the show has three seasons on NBC.
And each episode began with the anthemic statement, we were boldly going on a five-year mission. And we discovered that the real adversaries weren't the Klingons. It was the NBC programming executives. They aborted our five-year mission in 3 years, but we showed them.
Well, I mean, could you have envisioned in 1969 when the show was taken off the air that in another decade we're going to be this mega movie franchise?
Well, I said when we were filming the pilot, I smell quality with this show. I said that to Jimmy Doohan, who played Scotty. I said, because this is a quality show, that means we're doomed. Because every show that I loved, that I really enjoyed, lasted no more than 2-3 seasons. And I said, you know, we're going to be canceled soon. And sure enough, my prediction came true. But that's the way it is in show business. You know, we have closing nights in the theater. We have cancellations in television. With movies, we have the rep.
But this show rose from the ashes like none ever has.
In two more years, we're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary, the golden anniversary of Star Trek.
What is it about the show that has this kind of hold on people that has lasted for, as you said, nearly half a century? What is it?
I think at the very core, Star Trek looked to the future, and we talked about the 23rd century, with optimism. It was a bright future that we envisioned before us, where most science fiction see a dystopian society, you know, either the humans grubbing around in the ruins of a once great civilization, or being ruled by apes or machines, robots, you know. We said, no, if we have confidence in our problem-solving capabilities, our inventive genius, our entrepreneurial spirit, we can meet every challenge, working as a team and a diverse team, and go on to the next frontier. It was a very optimistic show, and I think that was attractive to people. Whereas, I guess dystopian societies, too, are attractive to people because those stories get told and are very successful as well.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. You're listening to a rebroadcast of our November interview with actor George Takei. Coming up, we'll continue that interview and we'll get into George's role as a celebrity activist and the Broadway musical Allegiance. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and today we're looking back at some of our favorite science and sci-fi segments from 2014. We're continuing now with my interview with George Takei, who was a guest on the program back in November. And we'll pick up with George's response to a caller who asked about his role as a celebrity and about his activism.
The greater audience could benefit from you talking about your activism in the Japanese-American community, as well as the gay community. I know two very wide subjects, but if you could speak just a little bit, I think listeners would really benefit from how you have shown a light on those two communities.
And your activism goes way, way back. But thank you for bringing that up, Jake.
Well, you said my activism within the Japanese-American community and a separate issue with the LGBT. They're both related. They both deal with equality in our democratic system. When I was a child, Pearl Harbor was bombed, and this nation went into was swept with hysteria because now we're Japanese Americans, American citizens. My mother was born in Sacramento. My father was a San Franciscan. They met in Los Angeles, and I was born there. But we looked like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. And this nation was swept by this hysteria. And they looked at Japanese Americans in the same way that they looked at the people of Japan. We were looked at with suspicion and fear and outright hatred. And President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was swept up in this hysteria and ordered all Japanese Americans on the West Coast, roughly 120,000 of us, to be rounded up with no charges, with no trial, with no due process, and to be imprisoned behind these barbed wire prison camps all spread out through the most desolate parts of this country. We were sent to a camp in the swamps of southeastern Arkansas. And I relate that to the LGBT movement, because the Japanese Americans were incarcerated in very real barbed wire encampments. The LGBT community, up until very recent times, were imprisoned in legalistic barbed wire fences with the sharp, hard barbs of ignorance and bigotry in them. But LGBT people are innocent people. We've committed no crimes, but discrimination put us, LGBT people, behind those legalistic barbed wire fences. You know, when I was a kid, it was illegal to be gay. If you gathered in a gay bar, the police came to raid you, and they booked you, they fingerprinted you, took your photograph, and had your name on a list. Now, if that were exposed, was disastrous. It was catastrophic for gay people. They could have lost their jobs. They could have lost their families. And their lives became hopeless. Horrible things happened. And those that were serving in the military heroically, patriotically, when they were found to be gay, they were publicly ostracized and fired from their jobs, from the military, people that were defending this country. And certainly none of the civil rights were available to LGBT people. We are the children of straight people. We are literally members of the family and still regarded in that way. Thank God now we live in a much more enlightened society. Two-thirds of the states in the United States grant marriage equality. And yet still today we have a third of the United States that don't. But I'm very confident that within the next few years we will be able to pledge our allegiance to the United States of America. So, you know, the imprisonment of innocent American citizens who happen to be of Japanese ancestry is parallel to this story of what the LGBT community has gone through and still will have to go through in order to be totally full American citizens.
You came out, you made the choice to be openly gay about 10 years ago now. What went into the timing of that decision? Obviously, a very personal decision. What led you to make the decision that I'm going to let the world know who I really am when you made it?
Well, I've been closeted most of my life because I wanted a career. I passionately loved acting, and it would have been pointless, stupid to hope to be an out actor. No one would have hired you.
So during the height of Star Trek, if you had been open about your sexuality, what would have happened?
I would have, you know, met some kind of accident. They might have given me a red shirt, put me in security, and I would be gone. It was suicidal to be out and think you can pursue an acting career. But because of the gay liberation movement that was going on, things were starting to happen. Things were starting to change. And in 2004, Massachusetts, Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts granted marriage equality. That was the first state. But in 2005, something equally precedent-setting happened in California. Our California state legislature, both houses, the Senate and the Assembly, passed the Marriage Equality Bill. The first time it came through the legislative route, it went to the desk of the governor, and with his signature, it would have become the law of the state. But Arnold Schwarzenegger, the movie star, was the governor at that time. He ran saying, "I'm a friend of the LGBT community." Yet his base was the conservative Republican side, and that's what he played to. He vetoed it. And I was so livid, my blood was boiling, that I had to speak out on that issue. And I decided, well, I've had a good career. Now maybe, you know, is the time to gracefully fade out. And so I spoke to the press for the first time as a gay man, and I blasted Arnold Schwarzenegger's veto. And I've been in the advocacy arena for LGBT equality ever since then, 2005.
So you were thinking, well, here goes. I may not get another job, sounds like.
But ironically, but yes. What happened was my career just blossomed. I was getting guest appearances all over, not as a character. Well, they were characters, but the characters were named George Takei, and those characters were gay. So I had a series of guest shots on television as gay George Takei, and also other things began to happen. And I got an invitation from the Howard Stern Show to be the official announcer. And then I met a tremendously gifted composer lyricist. I've been on speaking tours, speaking out on the internment of Japanese Americans. And we've also founded a museum called the Japanese American National Museum. But these were all reaching people through their brains, their intellect. We needed to reach them also in their hearts with the power of drama and the power of music. And I found this tremendously gifted composer-lyricist, Jay Kuo, and developed a Broadway-bound musical, which we opened first in San Diego at the Old Globe Theater, where we broke all box office and attendance records.
An award-winning show.
Indeed. We won the Best New Musical Award from the San Diego Critics Circle. And we are now Broadway bound. Next year, 2015, is going to be the year of Allegiance.
And I want to talk more about Allegiance, the nature of the show, and your experience as a child being in these Japanese internment camps.
Japanese American. We weren't imprisoned by the Japanese.
Right.
That's what the term Japanese internment camp suggests. We were in U.S. internment camps, and I always point that out.
And I'm glad you emphasized that. It is a dark chapter in American history. You spent part of your childhood as one of the 120,000 Japanese Americans placed in these internment camps. You were there between the ages of 4 and 8.
Actually, 5 and 9.
5 and 9, okay. Yep. 5 and 9, those are very formative ages. What do you remember about that and how you dealt with it?
Well, I remember the barbed wire fence, obviously. That was the most prominent. That and the sentry tower were the most prominent. I also remember—
The sentry tower. So there's a guy up there with a gun who's going to shoot you if you try to get away.
Machine guns pointed at us, yes. But, you know, to a child, you adjust, and it became part of the landscape. I mean, it's grotesque and abnormal, but it became part of my landscape. It became normal for me to line up 3 times a day to eat lousy food that everybody complained about in a noisy mess hall. It became routine for me to go with my father to bathe in a mass shower. At night, searchlights followed me when I made the night runs from our barrack to the latrine. But, you know, as a child, I thought it was kind of nice that they lit the way for me to pee. You know, so it was my child's perspective. I also remember, with irony now, we started the school day in a black tar paper barrack with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry tower right outside my schoolhouse window as I recited the words, "With liberty and justice for all." An innocent kid, just reciting words that the teacher taught us. But as a teenager, you know, after the war, I couldn't reconcile what I knew to be my childhood with all the civics books that I was reading, with the shining ideals of our democracy. And, you know, I heard people like Dr. Martin Luther King, and he was inspiring. And, he talked about the ideals of democracy and the struggle for it. And so I engaged my father in long and sometimes heated discussions after dinner. And sometimes, you know, I said things that I regret now to my father because
What did you say?
Well, one of the things I said that still haunts me is, "Daddy, you led us like sheep to slaughter when you took us into the internment camp." And I immediately sensed that I had struck a nerve because he became silent for what seemed like, you know, a long, long time. And then he looked at me and said, "Well, maybe you're right." And he got up and he walked away and walked into the bedroom and closed the door. And I felt like, you know, I've got to apologize. But he closed the door. And so I thought, well, tomorrow morning I'll apologize. And then it was awkward then, and I never did apologize. And that is one big regret I have in my life that, you know, I need to atone for. But that man, my father, explained our democracy to me. He said, "Our democracy is a people's democracy, and it can be as great as a people can be, but it's also as fallible as people are."
That was sci-fi legend George Takei, who spoke with us in November about Star Trek and told us his distinctively American story as a Japanese American and gay rights activist. We've spent today's Essential Pittsburgh looking back on two of our favorite science and science fiction guests from 2014. Essential Pittsburgh is produced by Marcus Charleston. Our assistant producer is Heather McLean, executive producer Tammy Turwelp, and a special thanks to our interns, Nikki Abin, Reed Carter, and Kurt Samsel. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. On behalf of everyone with Essential Pittsburgh, and from all of us at 90.5 WESA, we wish you happy holidays and a very happy new year.